Before I begin this episode, I would like to acknowledge that it was recorded on the lands of the Bundjalung people of the Arakwal Nation, and that they have been telling stories on this land for thousands of years, as well as performing music and speaking poetry. And I would like to acknowledge their elders, past, present, and emerging. What is up, everybody? My name is Luca Lesson, and I'm here with you for another episode of the Future Ancients podcast. I hope you're all feeling uplifted out there. Hope you're all feeling strong, centered, grounded. And for those of you who are struggling at the moment, I hope that this episode of the podcast brings you some sense of resilience, empowerment, growth, and hope in these dark times. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by my patrons, those good people that are on Patreon that have donated a small chunk of their earnings to bring this podcast and all of my other forms of art that I create to life. They really are something special, these human beings. I really appreciate their support. And if you'd like to add to that and to become a patron of my work, you get many different kind of benefits and gifts if you go to patreon.com/LucaLesson. And there you will find different options for supporting my work, and the quality of this podcast and all of my work will rise as we all do together through that connected process on patreon.com. Much respect. My dream for this podcast is to never have ads, to never be reading out some script from some company that I don't really agree with, just for the sake of keeping my art alive. So I'm sticking by my patrons, and I hope that they stick by me as we continue to create a better world together. This episode of the podcast, I'm talking to someone extremely special, actually. I think that this lady is a very powerful human being. She is playing the long game that we talked about a few times in our conversation. She is the senior curator of Southeastern Aboriginal works at the Museum of Victoria. A very important role for connecting with culture, art, artifact, and all the spaces in between. Her name is Kimberly Moulton. She is a Yorta Yorta woman. She grew up in Shepparton and now lives in Melbourne City, or Narm, as it is called. And so this conversation was really powerful because we talked about and around this theory, this idea of the future ancients quite specifically, quite powerfully, I think, quite articulately too. Her travels around the world working in areas of decolonization within museums, as well as repatriation of artifacts and artworks in international museums, is just, for me, that's like, I was geeking out. That's like my favorite shit. Some of my favorite stuff to talk about is these ideas, you know. What do we keep behind glass cabinets, and what do we use? What is an artifact, and what is just a day-to-day tool that we use? What is a piece of art? What is something that is more practical? What is something deserving of hanging on a wall, and why, and how, and why is it something old, owned by certain people? How did certain Greek artifacts end up in the British Museum? We go into all of this. It's a really interesting podcast, and I'm actually already looking forward to having Kimberly back on the podcast again at some point. Thank you all for listening. At the end of this episode, of course, I have posted my poetic response to this conversation that I had with Kimberly Moulton. It was a really powerful conversation, and in turn I was inspired to post something that I feel captured this connection. So please enjoy my conversation with the great Kimberly Moulton. Hi Kimberly, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Are you sick of the isolations yet?
I've actually been loving it.
Yeah.
I definitely miss my family and friends and the social, I'm a very social person, so I'm definitely missing going out, but
Yeah.
it's just been nice to like write and reflect and kind of go into a little cocoon at home
Yeah.
as
Well,
well.
that's awesome. I guess I've been feeling kind of the same way. Part of that is making this podcast, just feeling inspired to do something with my time. So yeah, I'm really appreciative that you're keen to have a chat and be on the show. It's awesome. I've been, obviously we've been connected for a while through different avenues, but just watching your growth and watching your message grow has been really inspiring. And I guess one of the main things that I wanted to chat about is, yeah, just your connection to museums. Like, what's happening right now with the museum? It's obviously closed at the moment with COVID, but you still are working.
So I'm really fortunate to have, have a job and being in the arts, because everyone's just it's just devastating what's happened.
Yeah.
But the museum has shut and the doors will be closed until at least July. And then we'll wait to hear from them. So, staff might be able to go back sooner, but yeah, luckily with my work as a curator, I can kind of work from anywhere. I mean, it's nice to be sort of close to the collections, and a lot of my work is in the collections, but they're also on a database. So without physically being near them, I can still do my work wherever, really, as long as I have the internet.
Awesome. So how did this all happen for you? Like, I kind of know the last kind of few years thereabouts of your story, but at what point did you go, this is what I want to do? I want to be a curator. I want to work somewhere between museums and art galleries.
Yeah, I've always been very creative. So growing up, I was really encouraged, in terms of art and history and culture by my parents, by my father. My father was an artist and a Yorta Yorta man. So I'm a Yorta Yorta woman, grew up in Shepparton. And so I had quite a creative, childhood. And then I just went to uni and I did an arts degree. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just wanted to like get out of Shep and study. And so I did like Indigenous studies and art history, visual culture, journalism. And then I got into the museum after uni in like an outreach program. So I was taking collections out to people that couldn't get to the museum. So I was doing like fossils for children and so social history things for aged care and people with acquired brain injury. And then I also did cultural material out to different community groups as well. So it was sort of like an outreach, sharing the museum with people that couldn't necessarily get there. And that was a really good kind of starter in terms of understanding collections and how to talk to people and present and all of that. And then I started in Bundjalaka. My kind of area of interest has always been contemporary art and history. And I think as I've worked and got more experience, I've kind of have a clearer idea of what that means for me. But I started in Bundjalaka not long after. I was probably in the outreach job for about 6 months. And then I met Caroline, who was then she was manager of Bundjalaka at the time. She's a traditional owner of Melbourne. And she mentored me and I ended up getting a job there as the project officer, which meant I curated exhibitions with Victorian Aboriginal community for about 8 years in that role. So it was a long time to be there, but it's because, every few months I was working with a new artist, doing a new show, learning so much about the museum and the collections that we have there from our ancestors. And it was just, always changing. And that's what I love about the museum as well. And then, after that, I got the role that I'm in now, which is the senior curatorial role for the Southeastern Aboriginal Collections, which is New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, Tasmania.
Amazing.
And been in that for a few years. So that's
Amazing.
how I got there.
I read the article that you sent me. I really loved it. And in it, you describe one of the museums that you visited in Rome or in Italy as a mausoleum for cultural heritage. And I'm just wondering how, I think that's the experience for lots of museums around the planet. And you see yourself in the article, you talk about seeing yourself as a bridge. How is your work, how does it work at reversing that idea of the mausoleum, of this idea that artifacts that are dead things, and how are you working on revitalizing these things? How does that happen?
Yeah, I think, just at its most basic, it's about connection and ensuring that Aboriginal community can continue to have access and connect to our objects in these places. And so a lot of the research that I've done over the last sort of 5 or 6 years, I've been really lucky to get some kind of fellowships in international collections where I've been able to connect to our objects made by our ancestors. So, objects, some of them are over 200 years old. In fact, the first object ever taken by Captain Cook and Joseph Banks is one of those objects that I've spent time with. Mm. And for me, it's around connecting to them and almost like saying hello, like a family member you haven't seen in a while. And that's how I kind of approach those objects, because they still carry the energy of the maker and they still have an immense connection to the living culture of Aboriginal Australia. And so I suppose in sort of reversing or kind of dismantling these spaces that are, they are like, mausoleums, they're cold, stark storerooms where the objects come out and then they get put back in plastic and they get put back in a drawer. And, there's a couple of places I've been, and I've been the first Aboriginal person to see those objects since they were collected, by the colony or whoever collected them. So, I guess just making connections personally for me, but also for my community and knowing where these objects are, and then also letting community know where they are is a bit of a start, I think. And I mean, it's those places like the one in Rome that I was talking about, as I referred to as like the mausoleum. It was like this insane, concrete, massive museum that no one was there because it was like outside of Rome, and it's this big ethnography kind of collection all around the world. And there was some really important Victorian, materials there. And I had to use like Google Translate because I didn't understand English and I didn't understand Italian. And we got there in the end. It was
very cold. Did you have to Google Translate? Please give this shit back to us now.
Can I put it in my bag? it was interesting that, I go into some places and I'm very watched. I'm not left alone. They did actually leave me alone there, but they wouldn't allow me into the storeroom. I had to look at all the objects on a trolley in this other like weird amphitheater place. So
They're like hostages.
Still totally.
Prisoners.
So it's quite hard.
When I talk to you about this, and when I think about all this, I also think about the so-called Elgin marbles, the Parthenon marbles. It's probably one of the most famous conversations about repatriation, or the most well-known, I guess. And the negotiations and how long it's been since Greece, first of all, got independence from the Ottoman Empire. And then started, within 5 years, they'd set up the Archaeological Society after becoming independent. And then that, within 5 years of becoming independent, they asked for the marbles back. This was in the 1800s. So it's been this long conversation that's still, it's basically been met with a cold, hard no for a very long time. And that reasoning, one of the major reasons is that they see Greek heritage as human heritage, as the world's heritage, therefore it's ours. And even more so, they see ancient Greece as somehow Western, even though from what I can gather from all the reading and the conversations I've had with archaeologists and historians, ancient Greeks never considered them, that idea of Western wasn't in their minds when they were making and creating all of this stuff. It's been
since then that it's been gravitated and pulled more and more towards the West and this kind of cultural identity that they see as being more than just the Greek state and more than just the UK, really. It's like a European heritage that we must keep safe, and therefore it's our heritage, it's the heritage of man.
Yeah.
Is that a similar conversation when you were at the museums that you went to about the Southeastern collections that you were trying to have conversations definitely. About? Yeah.
Yeah. Like the justification for these institutions to keep the object is based on this notion of like, yeah, the universal kind of museum and the benefit of humanity, the study of our ancestral remains, you know, like people dug up our ancestors, right up and through, like right through to the 70s, early 80s.
Wow.
And, you know, a lot of the very early collections were sent overseas, and many of our ancestors are still over there, and there has been this justification also for the benefit of science, you know, in that context. But when I was actually at the Smithsonian, which is the natural history, Smithsonian.
Smithsonian.
Yeah, anyway, in Washington, D.C., and I went there to see some objects, in particular the possum skin cloak that they have. So there's only about 5 historical possum skin cloaks in the world. Wow. And the museum I work for have 2. One of them is actually from my country, from Echuca, and the other one's Gunichmara, which is Western District. Anyway, the one that they have there is the earliest collected cloak from 1840, and it was from an expedition of the Americans that essentially collected for the foundation collection for the Smithsonian as we know it today. So this expedition went out, they collected around 2,000 objects from across the world. There was a few hundred from Australia within that trip. And then everything that they collected in that trip became the Smithsonian. And now we have, you know, like however many Smithsonians there are. But so in talking with the curator who took me through, who was like, had been there for 45 years, and her interest was Papua New Guinea, but her area of remit was the entire Pacific. So you have these institutions that have curators that are in these roles for 40 plus years that will have a very like sort of narrow focus. I guess that means everywhere else gets neglected by them. There's other researchers that are going into these collections. Anyway, so when I was walking around with her, it was almost like she was seeing the Australian collection for the first time. And this cloak, you know, we're having this conversation around repatriation. I have to be strategic and gentle,
sure.
even though I just want to go in there and be like, give our shit back. But, yeah, but she basically said that, well, because I was trying to see if she'd be up for at least a loan, you know, because to get our objects home, it's not just sort of, I think, going in there and getting them all back. It's step by step by step. So if we get a loan that comes out, you'll have to go back, but then we might get a long-term loan, you know, and it's just kind of that playing the long game.
It's playing the long game. That's exactly what it is. I think a lot of quality social change is the long game. It's nowhere near as fun. Yep. Doesn't give you as many Facebook likes, but it's possibly more effective.
And it's not glamorous. It's actually very frustrating, and you need
totally.
Yeah, but she said the cloak was far too important to the American history to ever let it go. Quote ish. Wow. So. Yeah, that was really interesting to me.
Have it on display all the time?
No, they've never had it on display, and they don't intend to since 1840. But it's too important to the American history because of its connection to this trip. And it's the same with the marbles, you know, or, you know, your ancestors' objects. I hate that they're called the Elgin marbles. Like it's some old white dude that took them. Yeah, but
it's crazy because he took them because apparently, although it's contested, he got permission from the Ottoman Empire. So imagine your oppressor gives a visitor permission to steal your cultural heritage and then take it to Britain and sell it. And now it sits in a room and there's no legal way that you could You could dismantle that because it was legal, because he got permission, even though he got permission from an illegal occupation.
And the UK have, you know, they've actually legislated like objects within government. So they also hide behind the fact. So they'll talk about the Universal Museum or Museum of Mankind, but they'll also use law as, you know, as an excuse to not hand back those objects, because it's actually written into their law that they can't. And so then the museum trustees of the British Museum, for instance, will therefore say, well, by law, we can't hand these back.
Right.
But it's interesting recently with Brexit, and I don't know if you've read much about
that. I read a little bit about a conversation between the new Greek Prime Minister and Boris about possibly lending never before seen artifacts that have never been exhibited outside of Greece, kind of sending them out from Greece in order to get the marbles all together in one place in the Acropolis Museum. And France actually agreed. They said, yeah, that's a good idea. I think we'll do it. But I haven't heard anything else. Was that what you were talking about?
No, I hadn't heard about that. But there was sort of when Brexit was happening and the UN trade agreement, the new sort of, I don't know, EU negotiating mandate was getting put out, the draft was getting done. And they actually included a line around the UK looking at restitution and or return of cultural objects. And so they didn't specify that it was the marbles, but, you know, they're alluding, of course, to that. And that was sort of that, I know that draft was sort of going around the European Council. So it's interesting.
Interesting as though that's kind of like leverage. Like if you want to leave the EU, then, you know, you have to also not benefit from all these European and other artifacts that you exhibit as European culture if you're no longer part of Europe.
Yeah. I think like when I was over there a few years ago, I was sort of having these conversations. I did a lot of, I was at the British Museum, and I went to Pitt Rivers Museum is another one at Oxford University that hold a huge amount of world cultural materials. And it's just like, it's extraordinary. It's an absolute spectacle of a museum. It hasn't changed in, you know, hundreds of years. And they have really important Victorian Aboriginal cultural materials. And, you know, so I was going to all of these places and seeing these things. And I think the idea of repatriation for them of cultural material, ancestral remains are starting to come back. And, you know, places are returning them. But cultural material is different. And for me, you know, again, going back to that long game, you know, how do we, it's also about representation in these places. Like we're still, as in Aboriginal Australia, often are represented as sort of the primitive historic past. And, you know, maybe one step will be kind of more of us, more Aboriginal curators and community, like going into these places and having agency in the way that we're represented and our objects are displayed or cared for. You know, and then the next step might be getting them home, but I think there's a lot of work to do.
How did you feel when you held or saw the shield that was taken by Captain Cook on his very first encounter engagement with First Nations people? You had a moment with that artifact, with that shield. What was that feeling like?
The first time I saw the one at the British Museum was in 2013, and it was actually behind glass when I saw it then. And it was in the Room of Enlightenment as well. And there's all of these objects that, you know, that were taken during that period. And I knew that the British Museum had thousands of Australian, you know, objects. But there was only at the time two on display. It was this shield and a boomerang. But the shield has a bullet hole through it. And if you read through Cook's journal, they're actually available in like the National Library. But, you know, they're also pretty boring, like it's Cook's journal. But factually, it's interesting to kind of look at on the 29th of April, which was the day that he invaded at Kamei at Botany Bay. And he talks about shots were fired, a man got hit, and we you know, landed on a shore and we took the darts. So he refers to spears as darts.
Mm.
And so they took the shield at that point of conflict. And also they took heaps of spears, which are at Cambridge University now. But yeah, that seeing that bullet hole was, I think I said, yeah, in the book, like it felt like something went through my chest at that moment. It was so devastating to see this object in the context of the invasion, in the context of this being the very first object taken from Australia as well, in the context of museums and collecting. But also that our representation in this museum was a shield with a bullet hole through it. And that says a lot. And not much has changed. There's a few objects there now. But there is actually an Aboriginal woman working at the British Museum now as curator of the Australian collection and the Oceanic collection, Tasmanian Aboriginal woman. And she's doing a really great job. It's a very hard, as you could imagine, place to be. But
for sure.
Yeah, the history is all there.
Yeah. And obviously she is someone committed to the long game, the very long game.
Yeah, you really have to be. I saw a shield also in Berlin. So they have a shield collected by Cook on that same journey. Mm. So it's quite a profound sort of moment just being with these objects. Not seeing them just as sort of pieces of history, like living, breathing things that relate to descendants that are still here.
It reminds me of I was in London last year and I went to the Museum of Natural History, and I like that it's free and that all these people, you know, lots of kids are in there and they're just like having this time of their lives in this, you know, massive place with some really incredible things in there. But it also raises that question, you know, like I know you talk a lot about the conjuncture or that, you know, overlap between art and artifact. But also I wonder where natural history comes into it. When I walked through the room that had Australian wildlife in it that had been stuffed, and they look about 100, like they were stuffed about 100 years ago, you know, like they look extremely
they
old.
They probably were.
They probably were. Super dusty. It's like what you imagine of some like super dusty old, you know, museum.
Yeah.
It's like a set in itself, even though it's trying to educate, which I guess it does, but these poor old things look really sad, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, well, you know, like at what point if a First Nations community is super connected to the land and the animals of that land, at what point is also taking animals also a part of taking cultural heritage? And at what point is something like a zoo, you know, that much different from a natural history museum or a history museum? You know, there's like this overlap somewhere in all of that.
Well, there's a complete disconnect like with non-Indigenous people and like the history, the colonial history of collecting. There's a complete disconnect between First Peoples and their innate kind of connection to country and animals, and you know, that's non-human kin, whether that be environment or animal. They don't understand, or they haven't understood that connection is our central kind of being. And to take away animals, to take away rock and, you know, earth is just another layer of colonialism, you know, and another layer of taking and removing and dislocating, you know, what should be left on country. And I have thought about that, like even at the Melbourne Museum, the way that we, you know, look at minerals and rocks and things that have been collected and animals that have been collected, and how, you know, Indigenous cultures often in institutions are kind of siloed within like one space in the museum where there's like all of the artifacts and some contemporary works and whatever there. And there we have our animals and here we have our, you know, and trying to integrate and I guess...
But of course, if you put all those things together and you put them all together in their best form, then it's not a building. It's not just an animal by itself and a person over here, or the remains of a person or a living person, which happened in, I know it happened all over the world, but in Queensland, I know I grew up in Brisbane, there was the museum there had they'd taken Aboriginal people and set up a exhibition of living humans within the building. So this has also happened throughout history. But if you take all these facades away, you end up just with people living their lives in their normal ways, you know, and that's not sellable, I guess, because it's not separate from something and put into a building and tickets sold to go and see it, you know what I mean? So it feels like the system, I felt like when I was reading your article that the woman said that the cloak needs to go to sleep or something, I was just like, if it's dead or if it's sleeping, you were saying in your article that when humans connect with the object, when community connects with the object, then it comes to life and you come to life, the people come to life. It seems like for a capitalist society or a Western society, it can only come to life if it's on display and making money. Once it's making money, then it's alive, you know? Whereas this kind of vibrancy...
And then it has value.
Then it has value. Then it's not asleep anymore. It's like now it's alive again. Whereas for...
And I think certainly in the age we're at now with museums and galleries where ticket sales and visitation is, you know, like survival is around money. That's even more relevant. I think the value is really interesting when you're looking at collections, because the value of the collections that were taken over 200 years ago was about the empire and trophies of the frontier and kind of the dying race and capturing what was left of this sort of primitive culture. It was really interesting. I think like value in the sense of like authenticity is really interesting. And that's something I've kind of come across a lot and then been thinking around how kind of ethnographic collection and ideas around what's authentic and what's like real Aboriginal material, how that has influenced and continues to influence like contemporary art today and notions of authenticity today. And that kind of light bulb moment happened for me when I was, I think I was at Oxford at Pitt Rivers Museum, and I was looking at a shield from Victoria from, 1888 or whatever. And it had like the label, which are almost like objects in themselves now. They're really interesting, like these really old labels. And the guy who collected it had said, great specimen of, a primitive shield. The value somewhat impaired because of use of the white man's tool. So essentially he was saying, this old Aboriginal man who made the shield had used steel or glass because he'd used that. Well, the value is not as great because it's not really an authentic Aboriginal object. That I find really interesting when you think about value.
Yeah, I think that happens and still happens a lot. The couple of things I wanted to touch on just listening to you there. One is once when I went to Townsville, I was performing at a venue there, and the woman was like a theater maker, and she realized that I was Greek, and we started talking, and she started telling me about how she had this great theater teacher who was French, who really loved Greek theater. He was like all about teaching those classics and going deep into it. And every year he would go to Greece and he would bring back a present for every one of his students in this theater course. So every year he'd go to Greece, and while he was in Greece, he'd go to Epithavro, which is like the famous theater outside of Athens, and he would collect a stone for every single one of his students within the group and bring back like a piece of Epithavro, of this like incredible ancient site, for his students in their theater group in Townsville, Queensland, Australia. And she was telling me like she was mad proud. She was like, oh yeah, I've got my stone at home. I was just like, awesome. Great story. Sweet. Can I have a look quickly?
Yeah.
Can I have a loan, a long-term loan? Yeah.
Well, in our, Aboriginal culture, like you don't take stones from anywhere because you get sick. You get, you shouldn't have that piece of country with you. And yeah, like going back to this whole like capitalist agenda of having to own and take, that's just a perfect example of how disassociated, people are to what that country and what that piece of concrete or rock means, to the culture it comes from.
Yeah, and I think and like you said, those silos, that ability to kind of remove that one piece and look at that one piece separate from the other pieces and value it separate from the other pieces and sell it and destroy it and make your money for that time being in a short term kind of way and move on and take something else or also you kind of, there's different things that you destroy as you pull them away. They then become more valuable because, you know, as that narrative of the dying race also talks about this idea that, you know, if it's being destroyed, even though we're destroying it, then it must be valuable. So the land we're stealing is valuable, and what is being lost because of that stealing becomes valuable. And so all of a sudden there's this whole agenda that is a bit of a vicious cycle. And I guess that goes to the point about what you were saying about the marketing being from a white person, therefore it's not as valuable. That was something similar that I discovered when I was looking at Spencer and Gillan's photographs. I think we spoke about this when I visited you at the museum.
Yeah.
The Melbourne Museum still has those original plates of their photographs. And they gave a lecture at Melbourne University when they returned from their trip from Melbourne all the way up to Borroloola, NT and Gulf of Carpentaria and back. And in that lecture, they purposefully left out photographs of First Nations people wearing Western clothing because they're not as exotic, so therefore they didn't discover something. If someone's already wearing a pair of pants, then he hasn't been discovered by us. Someone else discovered him first, and this devalues the commodification of people's bodies and artifacts as well, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's not fitting the narrative that they want to draw on, or they wanted at the time to draw on Aboriginal people. And that's, I think that goes sort of links to why it's so important for mob, you know, to be representing ourselves in these places now. Mm. You know, this history, like I was thinking the other day, like, wow, 250 years of like resistance and survival and all of that. But, you know, in the history of our being here, which, you know, is from the beginning, but science might say that it's 65,000 years plus. Mm. It's so tiny, so, so tiny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess the only, I don't know if there's any good news anywhere, but I know that in terms of Greek history, we were colonized for 400 years and still managed to bring something back. So I guess that brings us to the conversation of decolonization and what that looks like in this space for you. Is it just people of First Nations heritage in positions of power in museums, or does it go beyond that in this context?
I think it's a lot of things. And and I mean, I like, there's so much amazing stuff that's been happening for those 250 years, you know, of colonization as well, with community and mob. But decolonization, I think it's really interesting because I'm constantly like changing my thoughts around it and what that means. And, you know, I don't think decolonization is actually possible in a colonial institution. I think, you know, I sometimes use that term because it's just, it represents something that I'm trying to achieve in terms of like creating anti-colonial spaces or non-colonial spaces, or indigenizing space. You know, Stephen Gilchrist is a Yamatji curator, and he speaks a lot about, you know, creating spaces in institutions that are for Aboriginal people, not just of Aboriginal people, and like, how do we indigenize space? How do we create safe spaces? You know, all of that kind of stuff. But I think maybe decolonizing the museum is, you know, repatriating objects. It's taking those objects back to community for, you know, their cultural centers and supporting them in that. It's having more mob working in institutions in lots of different ways as well, not just with Aboriginal objects. You know, like, we need people in like marketing and legal and all of these places that are so white usually. To have that kind of perspective, that Aboriginal perspective over things, because it's really hard being, I'm the only Aboriginal curator for Melbourne Museum at the moment. There's some other Aboriginal staff, but they're not in curatorial or content. So you know, it's, and that's really similar across lots of institutions in Australia.
Yeah, I was going to say is, I mean, in my experience, that type of thing seemed to be stronger in 2010 to 2012 when I was living in Melbourne, in Victoria and in Melbourne. Although I know that, you know, the resistance has been going on in many different ways all across the country. How does it compare, the museum that you're at, compared to museums in other parts of Australia? Is this conversation broad and is it happening to a degree everywhere?
Yeah, to a degree. And I think that Melbourne Museum, because we had this major redevelopment in 2009 of the Aboriginal Gallery, First Peoples Gallery,
right.
And that was like led by Caroline at the time, who was manager, by Genevieve Greaves, who was a Worimi woman. Lots of Aboriginal people were working on that project, and it also shifted the way that the museum worked with community. So it was no longer around like just consultation and going out and taking knowledge and then putting it on the floor through a anthropological kind of, you know, lens or perspective, but it was actually about community having their voice and co-curating with, you know, the museum. And there was a whole elders committee called Yulenge that was set up that is still going today. That was about 16 community members that co-curated the entire exhibition with us. So it was this massive kind of shift. It was decolonizing. It was, you know, completely reworking the way museums have approached, you know, Aboriginal culture before, particularly Museums Victoria. Like the museum I work for was started in 1854. Yeah. So it's pretty old. But, you know, decolonizing isn't just, you know, doing one good exhibition and having, you know, black staff. It's way more than that. And it's also being really critical of our own histories. The museum being critical of its history, I should say, like actually being really open about, you know, the ancestral remains, being open about the collecting and all of that and what they have still. And I think museums are yet to get there in terms of being really open about their histories.
Mm. And you just did a talk recently for the museum that was live online. I know the museum is adapting as well because it's shut its doors. What was that about?
Yeah. Everyone's pumping out.
Everyone's online, man. Everyone's got a podcast now. Shit.
I know. Everyone's curating their viewing.
Their channel.
Yeah. It was a lecture. So I'm sit within the research and collections department, and we were doing a lecture series. And there's a show at the moment called Mini Model Mega Exhibition, which is like an exhibition of mini models of things. And everyone loves a mini thing. Like
everyone loves a little matchbox car.
Or a little mini.
Little bonsai.
mini bar.
Yeah.
But
we'll talk about care packages later too.
Oh, yeah. that's for just secret. Just, it's a little exhibition on models and miniatures, and there's some First Peoples objects in there, but some of them were made by non-Indigenous people. So there's like this box called the Lasuth box, which is made in 1860, and it's all of these shields and clubs and so this family that were with the Tungurung people in the Goulburn Valley settlers made all these mini kind of weapons, and they're extraordinary. Like they look incredible, but it's made by white people, they depicted, like they painted these scenes of corroboree, you know, and getting together in 1860. So it's interesting. Wow. But I spoke about, and we've also got Captain Cook's cottage from 1930 made out of icing. So it was like the centenary of Australia. Everyone loves cake. I don't know.
I want to know the pitch. I want to know who pitched that in the meeting. I want to be there. But it's made out of icing. So, get this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we could go for that. Everyone loves icing. Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, I was joking. I'm like, maybe my lecture will be me breaking into the collections and just eating it live. Like this icing Captain Cook's Cottage from 1930. Yeah,
that sounds good. That's,
anyway, so I was just kind of looking at these.
An art installation in itself.
Yeah, I was just kind of unpacking some of these objects. You know, there's a model of the Eureka Stockade, there's the Endeavour, but looking at them through a First Peoples perspective in the context of 250 years, and it just happened to be Wednesday, like the anniversary of the invasion that the lecture was. So,
yeah,
it went down all right. There was like 200 people, I think, that tuned in. So
awesome.
Yeah.
200 minds challenged, hopefully.
Yeah.
And how much? Sorry?
Just getting people to think, you know, like differently, critically about our histories.
How much do you think what you do is actually challenging people to think in different ways? And how much do you think is preaching to the choir? Like how many of us have really just, we talk to each other about this stuff. The people that don't want to hear it, don't hear it. And their ears are closed to it. And they're not going to open, you know, anytime soon. And you can't force anybody to really, you know, deeply listen. And how many of like the 200 people that tune in do you think are challenged and maybe, you know, provoked by that work?
I think probably some of them, because I think they were probably thinking it was this, you know, lecture about this mini models exhibition. Like they knew it was a First Peoples focus, but, you know, there were actually quite a few questions that were fielded that we didn't answer live, you know, that would be considered problematic to say the least, you know, and that's just part of the job.
The old classics. That often. Some of the old classics were in there.
Yeah. Like, you know, well, we actually got one saying, are you sure that your presenter's Aboriginal? How do you know that she's Aboriginal? You know, that kind of thing.
And you just happen to have your birth certificate right there and all the documentation.
Here's a photo of my grandmother. actually is a photo of them from the mission. But yes.
See, we've got the same eyes, look.
You get all sorts. But it's interesting that are we preaching to the converted? I think about that sometimes because I think we're definitely in our little like bubble. Like I'm definitely in my inner North Brunswick bubble of like mob and people that, you know, kind of think and have the same values. But that's also the responsibility and kind of why I love the museum and art, contemporary art. Like I've worked a lot in contemporary art and doing curating shows with artists that are political, that have a message, because they're platforms that you know, sometimes people will engage with that might not necessarily engage with sort of Aboriginal culture in other ways. And I guess going back to that whole thing, like when you talk about repatriation, you know, in international collections, it's also about being strategic and kind of as laborious as it can be, trying to chip away, you know, at this kind of, I don't know, society that still has major kind of, problems and misunderstandings about our history.
Yeah. And I'm sure it can be, you know, it can also chip away at your own energy, you know, like how much energy can people have for being nice, you know, all the time? I know that sounds bad because it's good to be nice and everyone's also a human being even if they represent a system.
I'm not always nice.
You want to play, I guess if you want to play the long game, then that includes kind of just nodding and smiling a lot, which is it's got to be tiring, right?
Yeah, it's very tiring. And I've had some pretty just flat out racist things happen to me at the museum over the years, like pretty bad. Not from staff, from other people coming in to the museum. But also a letter in our archives that was from 1920 from the CEO of the museum then asking the police colony to go out and collect Aboriginal body parts and remains and weapons. And then there's like five volumes, a letter in our archives that was from 1920 from the CEO of the museum then, asking the police colony to go out and collect Aboriginal body parts and remains and weapons. And then there's like five volumes later of letters that I find that are all these letters back from policemen that have collected all this stuff, you know, and this is through that, but also being there for my community and making sure that they have access, they're safe when they come into this place, they get represented, you know, and there's an amazing contemporary art space at the museum as well. So there's lots of like great things happening. But yeah, it can be quite tiring. But that's why it's so important also to have other mob there. You know, the more strength in numbers, right? Like the more people we have in these places, the more support you have. And for me, going back to country is really important. Going back home, like I go up to the river. I'm really involved in the Shepparton Art Museum and Kayula Arts, which is the Aboriginal art space in Shep as well. So yeah, just being a part of things that are like good for your soul and good for your like cultural strengthening. Yeah, yeah. Having good mentors, all of that.
Yeah. I, you know, from a Greek perspective, it's kind of weird because I'm like second. My mum was born in Greece, but my dad was born in Australia. So I'm kind of second and a half generation. The last 5 years or so, I've really been like, I need to fill up my, my well. I need to fill up my energy stores. I need to be in Greece. I need to spend time there. I need to connect with it. My identity was becoming too much, you know, like anti-racism or anti, you know, pushing back against people that would see me. And now I get more racism for thinking people think I'm Arab, you know, because I got a beard and I'm dark, and that's the focal point of racism at the moment in the world, you know. And so because I have this kind of more fluid look about me, I also get racism in Greece. People don't think I'm Greek when I'm in Greece, because a lot of Greeks are much lighter skinned than me. So I just, the last 5-6 years have just been like, man, I just need to fill up my energy stores, you know, like that's what I want. That's what feels like the best thing for me. So spending time there was really powerful for me, and I've been going back every year. I don't know if we're going to go this year again, but there's ancient sites near the village that we visit when we do the poetry retreat that I run. And that's the closest thing that I have to really feeling that like direct connection of lineage to really ancient places. And it's a really powerful experience to go to those places and connect and just do nothing, just sit in the silence there and feel it, you know. There's basically a burial ground there, about 500 tombs that are outside the village from about 400 or 500 BC.
Wow.
And they're under excavation at the moment. So they don't have, there's no tourism welcome there. There's no signs. There's no nothing. But there's archaeologists that go there every year for summer for about a month. And going there is really... yeah, it's just really powerful. It's just really amazing. Most of the tombs have been pillaged over the, you know, couple thousand years. But there are still some tombs that haven't been opened that they found. And it's just like, it's spooky to say the least. But it's also just super powerful and peaceful, you know. This really peaceful, powerful place that I'm really lucky to have a connection to.
Yeah, and it is that filling the cup and like I said, restoring the spirit and going back to country. You know, you obviously have, you know, a very long connection to that place through your ancestors and now through your lived experience there. And you know, lots of us have connections to country, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. I think. You know, Blackfellas have a different connection, a longer connection to feel good, especially now. Like, I think this is going to change the way we all consider how we work and how we be. I know everyone's talking about that, but it's true. And what's important, which is kind of being healthy and strong culturally as well.
Yeah, and I think it's powerful to support each other to do that. And I also actually think it's powerful to support people who regard themselves as white Australians to also do that. I've had many experiences where people are just like, oh, I'm just white and I don't have a culture. And I think that there's something about that denial of your own connection to a place that means that you also deny other people's connections to place, that you somehow can't see it. You don't value it because you don't do it for yourself. Whereas there is incredible, powerful history in all different parts of the planet, including the UK. And it deserves to be recognized, you know, within people that are here, that instead of just saying, oh, I'm just Aussie, which somehow means you can stake a claim to this place, even though it's off the back of invasion and it's incredibly problematic. Somehow, because you deny, you know, an ancient past, you somehow are trying to legitimize a modern past as, you know, the last 200 years is enough and that's who I am. But I think it's much more powerful to recognize something more ancient than that for everybody.
Yeah, I think it can give other people a sense of belonging as well, because it's about understanding the shared history and the shared spaces that we have in this country. Yeah, I think it's like that whole I'm an Aussie thing, you know. Yes, it's a denial of like not only Aboriginal history, but also like the however many, you know, different communities now coming from all across the world that call this place their home. And it's also almost like this, I'm an Aussie, I was, you know, we were here first, as in like first to colonize. So we have a claim. You know, go back to where you came from, like kind of thing, which is just fucked. Like, sorry.
No, please.
Yeah.
That's the first swear word on my show. I love it. Perfect context.
Put a warning for the kiddies. National identity is really interesting. Thinking about Captain Cook's Cottage actually the other day. And this whole like, and Captain Cook didn't even live there. That's the most ridiculous part of it. It was his parents' cottage. And they, you know, brick by brick, they packed it up from Yorkshire and then they sent it over to Melbourne in 1930 and or 34 or whenever and built it again on Kulin country. You know, it's like this monument to colonialism. And it gives, like, but you can actually still go there and get dressed up in like ye olde clothing. And walk around the cottage.
Sounds like fun.
Maybe we should do that one day.
I was just thinking, actually, it could be a mad twist to that. I think that could be
reenact.
Next time we'll get you on the show. We'll get you on the show again and we'll do that. That's the next time you're on. We'll go do that and see
what
happens.
We're out of ISO. My first point
Oh man, that's not my first thing. What's your first thing you're gonna do when it's over? You reckon there's gonna be some mad music festival that's gonna go crazy? People are just gonna lose their shit.
Hopefully, like I'm meant to be going to Boogie, which is this mad festival that I go to every Easter, and they've postponed it to October. I don't know if it's going to happen. I hope it is. But that will be a lot of fun if it happens. I don't know, just going to a pub with my friends or without having any fear of, you know, touching shit or each other. Going to Brisbane and seeing my fam up there and people up there.
I don't know. Did you grow up in Brisbane?
I did actually do a year of school there as a kid. Yeah. I lived with my grandparents, my mum there. But I grew up in Shep for the rest of for my entire life, pretty much.
Ooh, I haven't been to Shepparton, and I know it's a kind of small place, but I grew up in Brisbane and I found it difficult. I'd never lived in any other place in the world. And I was still like, this isn't my place.
That's a country town.
I think it's like, better now, actually. I think there's a vibe now. But when I was growing up there, oof, man, I found it pretty difficult.
Yeah. A few friends have said that, actually. I mean, Shep was back then, yeah, a bit smaller. It's pretty like urban regional town now. But yeah, it was pretty difficult. Like, there's still a huge amount of racism that happens back in Shepparton. And
yeah.
I grew up, you know, going to Rumbalara footy. Like, my dad was really involved in the Rumbalara football team, the Aboriginal football team that's in Shepparton. And I still remember, you know, being like 14 and hearing like the racism from the field, or from the sidelines to the field, you know, when we traveled around like country towns to support the boys and that. And yeah, and nothing much has changed. Things are changing there, I should say. There's a lot of good people in Shep and a lot of good things happening. But Australia, yeah, mate.
Neil still spends a lot of time out there, eh? Neil
Morris?
Yeah, Neil. He
goes back there a lot. As like he was gigging back there, actually, on the last time I saw him there. There's still a lot of mob, you know, that are really connected, like Adam as well, Briggs. You know, like he's amazing work at the Shepparton Art Museum. And so she's the first Aboriginal curator that they've got there. And she's Belinda, I should say. She's creating so much amazing work with the team at Shepparton for community and for art in that space. So there's a lot of things happening. That are really positive for community back there.
Awesome. Hey, I want to touch on one last thing. You are now on the board of a project or a process whereby people can assist First Nations artists that are going through all the crap that comes with this COVID-19 process. Is that right?
Yeah. So I'm on the board of Barpadilla Foundation, and Barpadilla actually means morning star in Yorta Yorta language. And it's a foundation that it's like a non-for-profit organization that Adam Briggs established, and Nathan Leach, who's a Kwandamooka man, is general manager. And it's got a really, you know, deadly board, and they're doing basically it's to support people, First Nations people across Australia in music and art. We've been running a campaign, to help First Nations artists and a lot of the musicians that, you know, were doing a lot of work with Barpadilla, that lost all of their work because of COVID. And so there's a campaign to support those artists. But also Barpadilla, you know, is just a really important foundation for young people, especially. And Bad Apples is connected, which is the record label as well. And so we're actually based now in Collingwood, out of the new Collingwood Arts Precinct called The Yards. And so Barpadilla is there, Bad Apples is there. There is a whole design team called Black Voltron, which is Nathan, who has a business called Banana Lands, who does the Black Flag shirts. Gammon Threads, House of Dizzy, a whole heap of like, you know, black designers doing deadly work as well. So that's also in the hub. But we're also, really supporting young black musicians, you know, in Melbourne, but also across Australia.
Barpadilla, man.
Anyway,
is a center. That is a center for creativity. Yeah. So how did I'll put the link somewhere. I'll put the link in the description for this episode. We'll figure that out. But yeah, that sounds like a crazy hub. Bad Apples is just doing the most amazing shit over the past couple of years. It's just been like one after the other after the other. It's so much respect for that crew. It's incredible.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting. And also, you know, with Barpadilla and Nathan leading that, with Adam and the rest of the board, we're really excited for the future there. I think it's going to be really, really good. There's an Instagram and Facebook and all of that, so you can just add us via the socials.
Amazing.
That felt like such an ad.
papadilla.com.au. You know that article that I read? Is it online? Can people access it?
No, it's in a book called Sovereign Words, Art and Criticisms, awesome. Which you can get in different places. I know the IMA in Brisbane have it, and Readings might. So you can awesome. Just look that up. It was published the Office for Contemporary Art in Norway. So that's got a heap of writers, amazing Australian writers like Daniel Browning and Hannah Dunnelly, Megan Cope, mm-hmm. Layuli Eshraji, one of my dear friends, but also someone that I just fan over, David Garneau, who is a Métis First Nations man from Canada, scholar and incredible artist. He writes in that as well. And he's got really interesting perspectives on non-colonial theory, anti-colonial theory. So yeah, it's pretty deadly.
Awesome. Sovereign Words. We'll look mm-hmm. that up. Perfect. Thank you so much for coming and having a chat.
That's all right. Thank you for having me on and doing amazing work, Luca, as always.
Pleasure. Pleasure. I'm just trying to do what I can from lockdown. That's about it. I'll go put my lockdown sweats on after this.
Yeah. I'll get changed out of my good jumper into my old jumper.
Totally. All right. Much love. Take care.
See ya.
Peace.
My family's prophets and word spinners, sinners, sermon givers, one size gypsy, though they'd hardly admit it. Actors and performers, storytellers in the business, hustling quotes on cobblestones in the village. I'm sure my old folks spoke a poem at the Olympics, back when they considered a lyricist a kind of gymnast. So I backflip and deliver these syllables you witness, but you'd never seen an immigrant killing it quite like this kid. So it's papyrus and a pen, that's how I never let the general public get in my head again. I never let them tell me my message is negligent when we evidently invented every second letter they tell me with. I'd rather fly than stay safe, rather be Icarus than be trapped in this maze. What's the point of risking our lives to arrive in this place if we never ignite and make change? I'm a living artifact, shaking the dust and digging up the facts. My ancestors have got my back. Your ancestors have got your back. My culture is older than the Colosseum. They took our knowledge and our gods and locked them in the mausoleum. I try to live it like it's Carpe Diem, but Australia's just a large-scale British museum. Smoking green, getting Rosetta Stone, Ionian columns, indigenous home. They stole a generation like Indiana Jones, and the survivors still try to repatriate bones. This place has got me enraged. Honestly, I'm in a love and hate like a constellation in Ptolemy. I find solace in prophets and prophecies and my genealogy between the pages of the Odyssey. I rap so I can stand next to Sappho. Homer's my home run, man, that's why I'm a natural. Full circle, 3.1415. It's time I got my piece of the pie. I'm a living artifact, shaking the dust and giving up the facts. My ancestors have got my back. Your ancestors have got your backs. Always. On the day that we departed, Artemis taught us how to never miss a target. The village in Greece is where it started. They wait on our return like we're the Elgin marbles. Statuesque but too trapped to move. It's like Medusa, goddess wrapped in a view. I send a message to Ares, asking what should I do? Got a message from Hermes, said you're a messenger too. So I speak like Prometheus, giving people the fire again. And spit like every line is a spark left to inspire them. And every sentence is part Spartan legend and part laced with venom. And half a Aristotelian night. I'm never scared or afraid of them. Born Australian, but I rep the Mediterranean. And I'm not scared of Greeks either. I tell them that we learn from black teachers, like, what the fuck you think happened when Pythagoras went to Egypt, man? It's all divide and conquer. We can never let it defeat us, never let it defeat us. I'm a living artifact, shaking the dust and digging up the facts. My ancestors have got my back. Our ancestors have got our backs. Your ancestors have got your backs. Ancestors got my back. Your ancestors have got your backs. It's a fact.